Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Alright, Lisa, how are you ready for this?
Cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us. Nobody
told me that these days like this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame, fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 438 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced. UFOs, unidentified flying objects. This week, the first in May 2007, weekly editorial contributor Dave Furlott, our space correspondent Michael J. Woods, famed Roswell investigator, author of numerous UFO-related books, writer of science fiction, and major in the United States Army Reserve, and Iraq veteran Kevin Randall. And taking us home this week, Alfred Lemberg. These are strange days indeed. And remember, you get what you pay for. An email comment from Bubba on last week's Strange Days Indeed. He writes, "Hi, Errol. I've listened to Don Ecker in doing his farewell tour on your show and others, slam ufology and progressive politics on the way out the door. Isn't it enough to voice frustration with the field and simply declare a new direction? But Ecker doesn't voice having a problem with 30 years of ufological conspiracy theory when it involved the Red Scare and conservative conspiracy. Like everyone having to do with American politics, and what isn't involved with American politics, like it or not, we've been so dead set on voicing conservative policy as common sense over the last 20 years or so that we've been talking about government cover-ups and disclosure, and maybe it goes unnoticed. I've always thought that a certain amount of conservative rage and dark paranoia drove a portion of ufology. Behold the pale hoo-ha? Maybe now that the political tide seems to be changing, and hence the language, Ecker is a little resentful. Factually, one could state that the present White House administration is one of our most secretive and corrupt in modern history, and disclosure under those circumstances seems to be unlikely. But as far as ufology and ufologists ever having been politics-free, well, my a***. And as far as slamming people like Stan Friedman, Alfred Lemberg, and others on his way out to pasture, well, it's easy to make those statements now that one has decided not to participate. Have all class acts gone out the same way? I don't remember Velez banging anyone's fingers in the door when he left to take a richly deserved vacation from the subject. And that from Bubba down there in Carolina. As I keep saying, your feedback to this program is important and useful, and also of great interest to me. The address, as always, is sdi@virtuallystrange.net.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
I happened to see the special on the incident in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania during the weekend, and it got me thinking. For those of you not familiar with the program, it concerned a crash of something near the town of Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, back in 1965. Now, the main reason this program caught my attention was because of the official position of the people who came out to investigate it. and the people that came out to investigate it were the U.S. Army. Now, the published official report states that nothing happened near Kecksburg on December 9th, 1965. Oh, and incidentally, the actual report comes from the Pennsylvania State Police, not the U.S. Army. It sounds like basically one government agency covering for another government agency. Now, that's all fine and good, but I have a tiny little problem with it. When reports start coming in about a bright glowing fireball in the sky, the Army dispatches troops to seal off the area and find whatever it was that fell to Earth. And there's testimony of people that got to the crash site before the U.S. Army did, and they state matter of fact that they saw something on the ground. Before they had a chance to get close to the site, it was sealed off, and a perimeter established to keep away prying eyes. But there was only so much they could do because people really did see something, and they weren't keeping quiet about it. Kecksburg and cases like it are nothing new to ufology. There are many cases from different areas of the globe responsible for establishing some official positions. Like Roswell, New Mexico, and the official position of the U.S. Air Force started out with, it was a weather balloon. And then later on, that was just a cover story because really it was a top secret project called Project Mogul, which used weather balloons. Then the U.S. Air Force again comes out with a particular position on something with Project Blue Book. And they established the official position that UFOs pose no threat to national security. Tell that to the airmen that came forth telling of UFOs that shut down ICBM sites and prevented them from being able to launch their missiles. I may be going out on a limb here, but I think being unable to launch missiles of any nature might just be considered a threat to national security. But the U.S. aren't the only ones that have established some official positions. After years of UFOs being reported in Great Britain, and after one of Britain's most significant military UFO incidents happened in the Rendlesham Forest in Suffolk on three consecutive nights in late December of 1980, the MOD, or Ministry of Defense, has come forth with a position that no evidence existed at all to suggest that UFOs were extraterrestrial in origin. Excuse me? So you're telling us that our various government and military arms have developed these magnificent craft that can do 90-degree turns, travel at speeds in excess of 10,000 miles per hour. Wow, that's really impressive. Then what exactly are we messing around with these huge rockets that really amount to nothing more than a huge bomb that we set off to get a space shuttle into orbit? And for that matter, why are we still working with space shuttles at all? Even people that have flown them compare them to trying to fly a huge cement brick. Now, France has recently released their documents on UFO reports going back some five or so decades, and even they have issued a formal position. But in true diplomatic fashion, their position is somewhat less black and white. France insists that there is no proof that UFOs are of extraterrestrial origin. However, there is also no proof that they are not of extraterrestrial origin. Okay, so in other words, let's flip a coin, because nobody is willing to make a decision. Bottom line, what it all boils down to is this. The overall position is UFOs don't exist, or they aren't from another planet or galaxy, or they are completely benign and they pose no threat to us or to national security. The problem I have with all of this is that if all of these statements are true, then an awful lot of money and time has been wasted by our military and government agencies in telling us this incredibly good news. To put it in perspective, they're telling us to be good little boys and girls. Now go away and stop bothering them about something that is nothing. Something that they scramble jets to intercept when they see them on radar. Something that they send out troops to an area of a suspected crash within an hour. And something that some agencies tell people to not talk about. what they've seen hours after it has happened. So all this is really much ado about nothing? I don't think so. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
You and I are both wasting our time doing what we do, Dave. They don't exist.
Of course not. They don't exist. They're not a threat. We don't believe that they're being piloted by anybody from anywhere else. Give me a break.
Think to come of it, Paul Kimball, Canadian film producer, director, who has made many UFO documentaries now, has his new documentary, Best Evidence, screening this coming week on Thursday on the Canadian Space Channel.
Excellent.
For our Canadian listeners. And it repeats on Friday morning at 10 a.m. this coming week.
We're going to have to definitely watch that because best evidence of nothing.
Yeah.
Speaking of evidence of nothing.
Yes.
What's happening with O'Hare? Anything on that?
Well, we're still apparently waiting for NARCAP. They're awaiting information under a FOIA request.
Oh, excellent.
They're almost done, apparently, and that should be out in the next few weeks or so. But as I often say, I'm not holding my breath. Because who knows when those FOIA documents will come through? In the same way that the Coalition for Freedom of Information, since you mentioned Kecksburg, are still waiting for NASA to release what they know about Kecksburg.
Mm-hmm. But don't forget, the official position on Kecksburg is nothing happened.
Yeah. Well,
that truck that pulled out of there loaded mm-hmm. with a tarp over top mm-hmm. of something, that really was nothing. Sorry, folks, you didn't see that.
Well, as Don Ecker said last week, it could have been a Soviet satellite or capsule that came down.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, in that special, Oberg, my favorite spokespuppy, Oberg actually said, no, it was not a Soviet satellite.
Well, of course. He works for NASA, and the Americans and the Russians have an agreement. Your toys fall on our territory, we give them back to you. If it was a Soviet satellite or a Soviet capsule, then of course Oberg is going to say, oh, nothing fell down on Kecksburg there. So you're kind of screwed whether they tell you or whether they don't.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because either they tell us that it's something completely ridiculous, or they tell us that, no, you didn't see nothing, go away.
Yes, but they're not a threat.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No threat, and very benign, just
very
as God
bless. Oh, my. Dave, good take as always. Look forward to next week's.
Me too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed.
To sit in the co-host seat of Strange Days Indeed many eons ago, it seems, but periodically now he joins us to report on the goings-on in space. Michael J. Woods joins us. Hello, Michael.
Errol, how are you today?
Oh, today I'm fine. Who knows what I was like yesterday or what I might be like tomorrow?
Well, if we could only get our quantum computers up to speed, we'd be able to know, wouldn't
yes.
we?
Yes, I'm just going to look ahead and see what I'm going to be like on my birthday.
Well, it's a bad day. Back to the phoning
yes.
in sick.
Yes.
Oh, the possibilities of a quantum computer are endless. It's not just the mere availability of one bazillion computers in other dimensions in link with the one you've got physically on your desk. I'm waiting for that one. How about you, Errol?
Well, of course. But you know what? Being the age that I am, I'm not holding my breath.
Being the age I am, I can't hold my breath.
Well,
I think I have far too many cigarettes in my youth.
Yeah, well, I think I would just fall over.
Well, exactly. Although I must admit the nice blue color in my face looks nice with my eyes, but we'll leave that go at that. Errol, there's been all sorts of astonishing news out of the conventional space sector in the last little while. And one, I must admit, if you're a pessimist, this is good news. It's good news because no matter how bad things get here on planet Earth, there's a chance of an escape hatch. It seems European astronomers have spotted the most Earth-like planet outside of our solar system. This newly discovered Earth-like planet is orbiting a red dwarf star called Gliese 581. Now, what's interesting is this is the planet that they've detected, and it's using that solar wobble. They watch a star, a distant star, and if they see a wobble in its orbit, it indicates that there's a planet pulling it off of its orbit. Well, they've discovered this one, and this is the most Earth-like ever. It's slightly larger than ours, and there are indications it has water. Whether or not it's liquid form, I suppose we'll have to wait until we get there to know for certain. Now we're starting to get really close into the parameters for what we consider requirements for life. And this one's a pretty close neighbor. You've got to admit, this one's nearby, only a mere 20 light years away.
Oh, that's exciting.
Oh, yes, just around the corner. I mean, just a nip down. If you think a nip down to the corner store for a bag of fags is a long way. So 20 light years, that's a bit of a haul. I think the nicest part is that the scientists have estimated the mean temperature of this exo-Earth at between 0 and 40 degrees Celsius. So
that's not bad.
If there's water there, which there are indications they've detected, then it would be liquid.
And very handy for manning the lifeboats at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Well, you know, let's face it, an ion drive on a generation, we use ion drives now for space missions within our own solar system. And so now it's all about a matter of scale. And let's face it, a mouse and an elephant are equal miracles of biology with one crucial difference. An elephant's bigger. So you need to build a bigger ion drive engine, but you could send out a generation ship, and about 40 generations from now, they'd get to that new Earth, and hey, forget what it was like to live on a planet. So the good thing, I guess, is that there is that out there. And this is the first Earth-like planet they've discovered out of more than 200 planets that have so far been detected outside our solar systems. So 1 in 200 is pretty good when you start counting stars.
I watched as Discovery Canada announced that they had found that planet, and there was the possibility of water, and I asked myself, how do they know that from the wobble of a red dwarf star?
Well, I think it's because of the spectra of light that they analyze once they're haloing the star.
Ah.
Because inevitably the planet will, but it is some trick, eh?
Yeah, 5 times the size of Earth.
No, 1.5.
1.5?
Yeah.
Oh.
Its radius should be only 1.5 times the Earth's radius. Should be either rocky like ours or covered with oceans.
Mm.
It has a mass that's 5 times ours, which means it's a denser planet.
Right, right.
Which means gravity is going to be greater.
Imagine weighing 5 times your own weight, huh?
That's not sounding so good.
No.
Even if you spend an hour on the Treadmaster, you know, it's not going to help.
Whoever we sent there would end up real skinny real quick.
This particular red dwarf is among the 100 closest stars to Earth, so it is a near neighbor. You know, to put it into perspective, it's only 20 and a half light years away. And light travels about 6 trillion miles a year. So, what are you talking about here? 120 trillion miles.
60 bajillion miles away.
Let's just say you better pack 2 sandwiches for the drive, okay?
Yes, and several hundred thousand tons of water.
I would think, and you'd best hope for a restroom along the way.
Oh, my.
After that, here's news that will warm the cockles of an expat's heart, no doubt. Her Majesty, the Queen. Ilios, my loyal subjects and your breakaway rebels. Queen Elizabeth is going to visit NASA's Goddard Space Center next month to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the English settlement at Jamestown, Virginia, and as part of her visit to the breakaway colonies, those rebellious swine, she's going to stop in at Goddard. And, of course, what they're doing is it's another in the ongoing efforts to link the Queen with something that happened after 1950. And it is a very nice linkage between that first English colony 400 years ago and God knows what colonies what we'll have 400 years from now.
As a matter of interest, do you happen to know what is at Goddard Space Center?
Goddard is the most important research center for NASA. Sciences, it's technology. This is where they sit there and dream up that stuff.
The think tankers.
The think tankers, the equipment testers, the science poindexters, all the good folks that do all the heavy intellectual lifting. They also do the space flight tracking and data acquisition. So they're kind of important. They're the key communications link for working spacecraft.
They justify their existence.
Yes, and what you would find there is a kind of concentration of intellect that would make you break out in a sweat, you know. Here's another little interesting piece of it gets more and more difficult to make the distinction between science fiction and reality. Not just, hey, this would be a good idea, but actual physical nuts and bolts development is underway for Star Trek-type shields for deep space craft. The idea is they would create a deflector shield by generating a magnetic field 20 to 30 kilometers out from the spacecraft in question. You generate the magnetic field. You fill the space around the craft with an ionized gas. The magnetic field holds that gas in place, and any incoming cosmic radiation hits the plasma and is slowed down and does not thereby go spiraling through spacecraft and any human bodies that are in between.
Well, that'll be very useful, won't it?
Yeah, the interesting thing is they're already planning the first laboratory test of this idea. They're going to create an artificial magnetosphere in a lab, and then they'll try a test satellite to see if it works in space. Well, here's the interesting part. We're calling it a Star Trek-type deflector shield.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually based on the concept done by John W. Campbell, and he was the editor of Amazing Stories in the golden age of science fiction and came up with the radiation shield proposal in 1936. Because, you know, everything is absolutely the day after tomorrow.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah, and the fax machine, it should be pointed out, first went into commercial use in 1927. There you go, kids. Blow your teachers' minds with that one. Now, climate change is on everybody's lips, and frankly, I think we should all get lipstick, or at least wipe our mouths and not talk like that in front of others. A lot of loud voices believe in climate change, and some equally loud ones don't. However, the current guru of all of this is the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They're the ones that have come out with the dire reports recently warning us that the future is going to be hot and sticky, and that may not be what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Included in an upcoming science report from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, are some last-ditch resorts if getting us all to cut back on our carbon footprints doesn't work. How about a big space umbrella? Would you like one of those, Errol?
Yeah, I could live with one of those, as long as it doesn't have any advertising on it.
Now, we're not talking about the nice little umbrellas that come in your drink.
Or in the backyard.
No, principle's the same. This one we're talking about would be a sun-blocking disc that would cover 106 square kilometers, weigh 3,000 tons, spin constantly, and orbit the Earth to block out some of the sun. This is one of the suggestions that's in this. Personally, I find that one interesting because in the IPCC report on climate change, it states that despite the measured increased output in solar radiation that we've experienced for the last century, which coincides with the current global warming phase, it states that solar radiation is not a significant contributor to climate change.
Ah.
If it's not a significant factor in climate change, why would we go to the rather formidable technological and financial test of building a giant umbrella to block the sun, because it's not really an element of climate change. So that's one for you. Mind you, they got some others in here. How about deliberate volcanoes?
I'm still thinking about the sun and how
giant umbrellas.
How long the sun has been warming up and warming us up.
And
how,
cooling us down. And
but it's been, what, 100 years now?
The current solar cycle, with an increase in output, has been about a century.
Mm-hmm.
It's been on this upcycle for about a century. And you have to admit it coincides rather nicely with the global warming trend of the same time.
Curiously.
Yeah, amazing that, isn't it? However, there's other ideas. If these are all last ditchers now. They admit this. This is the last ditch. If the Greenland ice fields were about to disintegrate and hump sea levels up a good 20 feet, this is what they might consider. Another one was, and I like this one, is artificial volcanoes. They'll scatter tiny sulfur particles in the atmosphere to reduce sunlight reaching the planet. Now, I thought most of us spent a fair amount of our time decrying smog, and particularly the particulate matter that compromises such an eye-irritating element of smog, so I'm not altogether certain that tossing little chunks of sulfur into the air is going to make anybody real happy.
Or anybody breathe any better.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, one idea that has been studied, the subject of at least 11 studies in different parts of the world, including here in Canada, is to salt the oceans with iron. You see, iron's a nutrient for the phytoplankton that live in the upper levels of the ocean. And those microbes absorb carbon. So if you scatter iron in the water, there'll be more phytoplankton. They'll absorb more carbon.
Oh, sink more ships.
Well, you know, I'm liking the notion. Well, I'm just thinking of grinding up the old iron just like you do for bulgeye or goldfish, you know?
Yeah.
Here you go, little plankton. No, you don't like those?
Well, they're not bad.
It's got to be easier than putting an umbrella up in space, because, I mean, goodness knows, I have a hard time putting up an umbrella on the beach, so I'm thinking that that could be rather problematic. And then this one crosses my desk, and you know, Errol, to bring it all back home to strange days indeed, the state of New Mexico, in conjunction with the city of Roswell, launched the Space Invader Scratcher Lottery Game. You betcha. Go down, plunk down a few ducats, and you can scratch and win, I don't know, a tour of the corn crash site?
Yes.
Second prize is two tours.
And the third prize is either Corona or the Brazil Ranch.
No, I was thinking you get to be Grand Marshal in the parade. Anyway, it's a $2 ticket. Top prize is 10 G's, and there's a second chance draw for $3,600. And not only do you get $3,600, you get a trip to the UFO Festival in New Roswell, which this year is July 5th through 8th.
Dennis Balthaser was on here a couple of weeks ago talking that up. And as you were saying, they got these lottery tickets. I figured, hey, I'm going to give Dennis Balthaser a call and get him to buy me a ticket and put it away among my Roswell memorabilia.
Absolutely.
And then if they find they don't have a winner, then I'll scratch mine.
You know. A good point.
Yeah.
Now, let us remember that it's coming up on the 10th anniversary of the year that you and I crawled all over Roswell and parts north, east, south, and west.
Yes, we did too.
And beyond searching for debris, as I recall, I spent most of my time looking for a good chicken fried steak, which I found at the Smokey the Bear National Park.
The home of Smokey the Bear we went
to. The home of Smokey.
And, in the mountains.
And I ordered up a chicken fried steak, and I can still remember that waitress. Honey, do you want grits on the side or just mess it all in there for you? So just mess them all in, honey chow. It was a beautiful vacation. And you know what? Those are some friendly people.
Oh, they are. They're wonderful down there.
Yeah.
We had such a good time.
The cooler parties at the various hotels after the daily events were a cross between any campsite, as long as you were at a campsite at the Woodstock of UFOs. Because you'd look around the cooler, and there would be a half a dozen of the highest profile names in our little area of interest.
All of us, I remember one night sitting in Rebecca Keith's hotel room watching Kevin Randall on...
Ted Koppel.
Yes, right.
Nightline.
Right. Yeah, Nightline. I miss Rebecca Keith. I don't know whatever happened to her. She disappeared off the face of UFO updates a few years ago.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Was Rebecca the one that accompanied us out to the actual...
Yeah, to the Brazel Ranch.
To the Brazel Ranch.
You remember going up that rocky riverbed to the...
And blowing a tire.
Yes, and going to the rock that apparently was hit by a UFO up in the Capitan Mountains there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely remember that.
Yes.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I would like to hear any non-UFO explanation for the damage of that rock, and particularly the shifting forward by a close to a meter of one half of that multi-ton megalith. You know that?
Yes.
Any type of rational explanation, I would love to hear, because I don't think there is one.
Me too.
Not with the shape of the break, the fact that it was not a horizontal but a vertical slice.
Yep.
Pretty astonishing thing.
Yes. We had a wonderful tour of the ufological sites down in New Mexico, courtesy of Rebecca Shaddy, Rebecca Keith, and the guys from HUFON, the Houston UFO Network.
They were great.
They were wonderful.
Weren't they, though?
Yeah, they knew
marvelous
all the spots.
Guides and, yeah. And fun people, taking it serious, but not too seriously.
Yes.
And with our, what I consider the key criteria in this line of investigation is open mind, but not so open that their brains fell out.
Yes. I have one more space thing that I'd like to hit on you for.
Okie dokie.
Whatever happened to the Mars rovers?
Now, it's funny you should ask.
The last time you were on SDI, they were both still going, and that was at least 30, 40 years after they were supposed to expire.
It sure seems like it. The Mars rovers were supposed to last 90 sols. A sol is a Mars day. It's close enough to an Earth day that we're not going to quibble over it.
Yeah.
It's supposed to last 90 days. Currently, the rover Spirit is in the dark, crawling across a crater on its 1,176th day on Mars. It's almost 1,100 days past warranty. Opportunity. It's in the sunlight right now. It's 1,000 days, 3 years, close enough, past its warranty. They're both operational, and they've even managed some long-distance fixes to extend the life of some of the tools that are attached to the rover.
Amazing. Amazing.
Now, if you're talking bang for buck, when you're supposed to last 3 months, and 3 years later, you're still roving and sending back information, you're getting your money's worth. These, like your 15-year-old car, it owes you nothing. Congratulations for all of our complaints about the defectiveness of our cars or TVs or stereos. That is the absolute pinnacle of human engineering, is the abilities to put robots on a distant planet in a hostile atmosphere and have them extend close to 1,000 times what they were supposed to last.
Hmm.
That's a nice piece of work.
It is, too. Is Marvin the Martian still cleaning off the solar collectors?
He has to be, because all the pre-mission studies and reports and analysis said this thing would likely die in 90 to 100 days because of abrasion to the solar panels and dust accumulating on the solar panels, reducing their efficiency. And eventually, they would die from lack of power, most critically when it reached Martian winter, and they couldn't maintain any type of warmth. And then they would definitely expire, the batteries would cease. It's never happened. They have noted a phenomenon that seems to wipe the solar panels clean. The only thing I can think of, we know that dry winds can be electrically dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to my hero, Robert Heinlein, who once wrote a book about an inventor, and one of these supposed inventions was a device that used a static discharge to make dirt jump away from the surface of a bathtub. Okay, it would discharge across that. And it occurs to me that perhaps when a windstorm zooms by the rover, it creates some type of discharge across the solar panels that is a reverse polarity to the dust sitting on it, and thus it repels the dust on it.
Amazing.
This is pure speculation here
from
the slightly bulging forehead of Mike Woods with not one shred of scientific evidence to back it up, which, of course, makes it just about the best kind of science possible. Disprove it, please.
It's like UFOs.
Oh, well, no, because, you know, people have this really irritating habit of taking pictures of UFOs. And UFOs have this really irritating habit of leaving physical traces behind for us to pick up on.
Yes.
So I'm afraid their basis in reality is a lot firmer than my speculation on who's doing the squeegee job on the rovers, you know.
And I still haven't heard science explain the hole that was punched in the clouds over O'Hare last November by a UFO. Can you imagine punching a hole in a cloud?
Witnessed by people who spend their lives watching devices go in and out of clouds and land in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, they wouldn't know diddly about an airframe in motion.
No, and 20 minutes that hole stayed there. You could see the blue sky through the cloud.
There are a lot of things that we need answers for.
Yep.
And thousands of credible witnesses and sightings and the dozens of trace element cases, the solid and increasingly growing library of video footage. Sorry.
Yes.
We opened up by talking about a planet with the firm belief that there exists 20 light years from here a planet that is similar to our own with liquid water.
Possibly habitable.
Possibly habitable. As you pointed out, all that's being determined by looking at light analysis and the wobble of a sun 120 trillion miles away. But we have a hard time believing that there might be satellites visiting us.
Mm-hmm.
And no one will give that a serious listen. So there's it's the same dichotomy in that we want to stop all the SUVs from running based on a very hysterical weather forecast for the year 2050. And since I know what the accuracy is of the weather forecast for next week, if I had an SUV, I wouldn't be selling it.
I keep saying this, but we've only been keeping weather records for the last couple of hundred years, you know? And
Who's got the best records? Do you know?
Who?
London. The city of London has the longest continuous meteorological records. They started gathering them in 1840-something. But remember that I'm a real believer these days in first principles.
Mm-hmm.
To heck with reliable weather records. We didn't invent the thermometer till 1788.
So how would we
know? So it's barely 200 years old.
And how long has this planet been going through its cycles and climate changes?
Oh, 5 billion years is it 8 billion years is the current estimate of the age of the Earth?
Mm-hmm. Well, look at Antarctica. It used to have a hard rock coastline. In fact, it still does until it froze over and the Turkish admiral or reis, Piri.
With his map?
With his map that was based on older maps.
Mm-hmm. Somebody saw that coastline clear.
Yep, and from above, too.
Mm-hmm. But in a more historical sense, in that or relative modern times, remember that the Vikings, the Norse, settled Greenland. Well, they wouldn't have called it Greenland if it was covered in ice.
No.
Covered in ice now. It wasn't then. And we're only talking 400 years ago.
Yeah.
The Norse were the bikers of their era, but they weren't idiots. If they'd landed on the place that was covered with ice, they'd go, let's call it Iceland. That's already taken. Well, come up with something else, okay? You know, they would have said, oh, Greenland. There's nothing green here.
He would have been called Eric the Blue rather than Eric the Red.
Yeah, right? Or maybe they all had colorblindness and we don't know. There you go. We've just opened up an entire vista of historical revisionism. The Vikings as colorblind travelers.
It's always a joy talking to you, Michael.
Well, you know, the mind veers until it aches.
Michael J. Woods is our space contributor in more ways than one. opens up my spaces all the time. Whenever I talk to him, it's just amazing. He has a full-time job. He's a senior news writer here in Toronto at City TV. And you can see his work if you happen to be in the area or if you happen to be online. What is it, citytv.com?
citynews.ca. Our ultra-zoomy webcast, podcast, interactive with live traffic cameras and more zoomy stuff than even our webmaster knows what's in there.
You can always get hold of him via SDI at virtuallystrange.net. We encourage you to do that. We need encouragement doing what we are doing and knowing that you're out there and happy with what it is that we are doing. Thank you, Mike Woods.
You're more than welcome, Errol.
We'll talk to you again soon.
You bet.
Yeah, another few sols before the Rovers finally quit.
We'll have the Black Band special broadcast when they finally decide that they've broadcast their last bite of data.
And we'll have a memorial service for them.
I'd probably drink a can of 10W-40 just to...
It's a miracle of engineering!
Where's my 3-in-1 oil?
Talk to you soon, Mike. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Is a name that I'm sure rings a bell with absolutely everybody who's ever been interested in this here UFO stuff. And Kevin Randall has been on this program several times over the years, and it's a pleasure to welcome Kevin Randall back. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Earl. How are you?
I am middling.
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it's not quite as good as fair to Midland, but it's in the middle there somewhere, you know? The weather keeps changing here and making my body and everybody else's bodies crazy, so...
Well, that's what you get for living in Canada.
Yes, it is, but we get to have a prime minister and not a president.
Well, I won't touch that one. We'll just stay away from that.
Oh, okay. I was hoping that that would just, you know, coax some sort of comment out of you, but I realize that you can't do that because you are a military officer.
I can say things in my civilian role as long as we don't attach it to me being a military officer.
Okay. Well, now I've said that, we can't say anything about him, so let's move on.
Pretty well done with that one.
Yes, we are. The idiot interviewer cooks his own goose. I guess it's been a year or so since we last talked. You had just come back from Iraq and had a relatively okay time there. You had managed to explore some ancient ruins and probably had a more interesting time than the average GI over there, I guess, huh?
Know about that. I mean, I got down to see Babylon, which was one of my goals, but some of our enlisted soldiers got into Baghdad to the Baghdad Zoo, and the big joke was one of the female soldiers was trying to take a picture of a monkey, and it stole her camera, and she couldn't get it back.
Oh, no.
So they got to do that, and the big palace that Saddam Hussein had, which is now in the middle of the Green Zone in downtown Baghdad, had this really fancy, beautiful swimming pool, and I know some of our enlisted soldiers got to use it frequently. I got to walk around outside it once to see the water and how pleasant it was, but I never got to take a dip myself.
And I guess being stuck in the middle of a desert without something to swim in can be pretty disappointing.
Well, Baghdad really isn't in the middle of a desert the way you would think of it, because the Tigris River runs right through the middle of town. There's an awful lot of water in Baghdad, and the thing that I noticed is when you get into the rainy season, which is winter, there was an awful lot of standing water around, and I always thought that in a desert when it rained, the ground soaked up the water right away, but there was an awful lot of water, standing water, in the Baghdad area. So once you got away from Kuwait and up north toward Baghdad, the desert environment sort of changed. And if you went north of Baghdad to Mosul, you ended up in the mountains where they had snow and everything.
Wow.
So this idea of it being this great, huge, open desert isn't quite right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of desert and that sort of thing, but Iraq is more than just a desert.
And to tie back into the topic of this program and the topic that we know you mostly for, did you come across any reports of UFOs while you were over there?
No, I didn't.
Ah.
And I really didn't look. We were busy doing other things.
I guess.
I did periodically check the latest 100 messages on UFO updates when I had a chance.
Uh-huh.
Which wasn't as frequent as I would have liked.
Yes, and nothing very much has changed there either.
I didn't really come up with any or hear any UFO reports while I was there. I talked to a few Air Force people in the course of other events, and it just was nothing that ever came up, and nobody ever saw anything that was worthy of note while I was there, which is not to say people didn't see things and notice them. It was just I didn't find anybody who saw anything, and there was nothing to really talk about.
Yeah, although in the last, 4 years or so, the lunatic fringe sites and blogs and lists have tended to report UFOs supposedly spotted over Iraq, I have noticed.
I really didn't see anything, didn't hear anything, but there seem to be a lot of UFO reports coming out of Vietnam. And I don't know whether it's just people kind of inventing the things for something to do, people trying to tie into the news of the day by reporting those things. I really don't know what it is, but they don't really seem to ever have any substance to them or any real meat to them. They're not really great reports, just somebody saw something anomalous in the sky. So I just don't know what's going on in that arena, so to speak.
Yeah. You're a major in the Iowa National Guard.
Yes.
Hence your trips to Iraq, and you are still involved with the National Guard.
Yes. Mm. In case your friends in Canada and other parts of the world don't understand, the National Guard is part of what is called the reserve component of the United States Army. And so when the Army finds itself in a situation where it's maybe strained in some fashion, they often call the Army Reserve and the National Guard to active duty. So we serve with the active duty components, and once we move into the active duty arena, and when we wear our uniforms, there's no way of telling the difference between someone on active duty and someone who is in the Guard and Reserve. In fact, my ID card now just says Army. It doesn't say Army Guard or anything like that. It just identifies me as a member of the United States Army. So it's part of the Army. The reserve component holds all the water purification facilities so that if the Army finds itself in a position of needing water purification, it has to call on the reserve component to get those. And the Guard provides other things like that as well, but they can train, they can produce these things at a fraction of cost, what it would cost the active duty forces to do. So we have some very specialized things that we do in the reserve component that the active forces don't train to do and can't do. I served as an intelligence officer while I was in Iraq, and my job was basically gathering information and disseminating it to the soldiers. Before we'd send out a convoy, I would find out what had been happening in that area in the last 24 hours and alert our soldiers to possible risks. Since intelligence to an Army mind is just information. What's the weather going to be like? What time does it get light in the morning? What time does it get dark at night? And it's not sunset or sunrise. It's what they call beginning morning twilight, so that about 30 minutes before the sun comes up, it begins to get light, and about 50 minutes before the sun comes up, it's very, very light out. So you look at all of those components and provide the information to the soldiers so that when they go out on a mission, there is well prepared for that mission as they can possibly be.
Got it. Thank you. I needed that explained too. The discussion about Roswell just seems to continue endlessly, doesn't it?
Yes. As you well know.
I guess handling each message that goes out to the list, one pays attention. Coming down to minuscule detail over and over again.
And that's one of the things that kind of annoys me about the UFO field, is it seems that every time we get something decided, we have information solving a case, we have a good explanation for a sighting, 5 years later we have to go through all of that again because somebody new has come into the field and they've read the earlier stuff, but they haven't got to the explanation. So we end up in these discussions of minutia that should have been resolved years ago, and we find ourselves doing it again. And I think one of the best examples is Bessie Brazel has reared her head. The discussion about her testimony has popped up again. And the thing that the skeptical community doesn't look at is Bessie Brazel stands alone. Her testimony is contradicted by practically everybody. So when she says, for example, that her father, Mac Brazel, didn't go into Roswell in the middle of the week and was not held at the base there for a number of days, she's in conflict with her brother, with what her father said to others, with what the Army has said, what the documentation has shown. So she stands alone on this, and we should be able to say, well, you know, Bessie Brazel's story, and I'm sure she's telling us exactly what she remembers as truthfully as she possibly can, but there's problems with it, and maybe we should not assign a great deal of weight to it. So we end up with these endless discussions going over the same things over and over again.
Yes, I wish that newcomers to UFO updates would take advantage of the archive that's there and go and search the archive and read everything there is to read before they post.
I'm not sure that on your list we went over it in great detail, but I know that there has been stuff out there in the UFO arena talking about her testimony. And we can take a look at her affidavit that was gathered by members of the Fund for UFO Research in the early 1990s. We can take a look at Carl Flock's book where he talks about what she said, and we can look at other articles that have been published since then where it's discussed Bessie Brazel. And the skeptics say, well, you know, you guys never talk about Bessie Brazel. And the answer is because she adds nothing to the discussion. She's out there all by herself. If it broke down into a half a dozen people telling the story like Bessie Brazel and half a dozen people telling a different story, that would be one thing, but it's not. It's her all by herself, and her testimony is just inconsistent with everything that we have, including the documentation available, the memory of the soldiers who were involved, what her own brother says, what the neighbors say. All of that stands sort of aligned against Bessie Brazel's story. I think she's telling us the truth as best she can. It's just not reality as we've discovered it in the Roswell case. So yeah, we kind of have to, yeah, Bessie Brazel says this, but there's really nothing to corroborate it.
Kevin, did you read Don Ecker's PDF file, his life in UFOs?
Yes, I did.
What I found interesting in there was the story of he and Dwight, his co-host, going to Roswell for the first time and bumping into somebody who claimed to have been an airman who was part of the mopping up operation out in the desert after the crash. Do you recall that story?
Thomas Gonzalez.
From Tomball, Texas.
Yes, yes, yes.
Did you yourself come across him at all?
I think Don Ecker published a short article in UFO Magazine about it right after he had run into Gonzalez. So I called Don Ecker and to chat with him about that, and he gave me the phone number, so I called the guy myself. Very old gentleman and very, very protected by his son. And of course, the only thing I wanted to confirm, I just didn't want to really quiz the guy again. I just wanted to make sure that what Ecker had reported had not gotten somehow lost in the filtering process as you write stuff down. I mean, we all think we hear things and we don't hear them quite right and we get things slightly wrong. But so I wanted to make sure that Thomas Gonzalez had said the things that he'd said to Don and was able to confirm all of that. And then the son became very irritated at me and that the conversation was more of an interrogation than it was an interview. And I'm thinking, well, gee, really, what's kind of the difference? But yes, Gonzalez said that he went out there. He said that he saw the alien creatures and that shortly after he finished with that assignment, he was quickly moved off the base into another assignment so that he would not have a chance to share that information with his friends there. The one thing that we did do back in 1947, the 509th Bomb Group, the group there at Roswell, had very comprehensive unit histories starting in April or May of that year and moving on through October, November, December. Very comprehensive. And part of what was in there was the number of people who were transferred to the base and the number of people transferred out of the base. So we could look to see if there was suddenly a large number of transfers. And what we found was that the number of transfers off the base remained pretty much consistent through those months. which is not to say they didn't target specific people to get rid of them. The numbers didn't change all that much. So Thomas Gonzalez said that he was transferred immediately. I have no evidence that shows that he wasn't. All I can say is that there was not a sudden house cleaning at Roswell, that the same number of people who were transferred in June were transferred in July. So there was no problem there.
Right.
So we have what Thomas Gonzalez says. He was not a member of the security police there or the military police there. He did not have a job that would have normally put him into a situation where he would have been called out to do something like this. On the other hand, and I've seen this repeatedly in my military career, when something happens and they need lots of warm bodies, they go through an area and pick up everybody who is not actively employed doing something and ship them out to take care of the immediate assignment. And that's kind of the philosophy, I guess, behind both the Marines and the Army, where you go to basic training and you're taught to be a rifleman, you're taught to be an infantryman, you're taught some of those basic skills, which of course is the term basic training, and then you move on to what they used to call AIT, which was advanced individual training. And for me, my advanced individual training in the Army was to be a helicopter pilot. Others went and got more infantry training. People went to school to learn how to be cooks or clerk typists or aircraft repairmen or radio operators. So the point is, it's not unheard of for the Army to take a group of people who might be assigned as cooks or mechanics or truck drivers and throw them into another assignment when they have a need for a lot of people to do something right now this minute. So the fact that he was not in a unit that you would expect to do something like that does not necessarily disqualify him.
Right. I think he told Don Ecker that what he saw he called moon men. And also that he'd picked up a piece of debris, which sat on top of his television set for many, many years. And then, of course, when it came down to actually finding it, they couldn't.
Yes, and we've had that happen lots and lots of times with vanishing debris. But he also made some carvings of the moon man that I know Ecker had published in his article. And I think I saw it again in the report that he just did online. So
yes, yes.
Don Ecker talks about his 20 years in UFO research and how we go over the same ground again and again and again.
Yes. I was going to ask you how you feel about that, how you see ufology changing over the years since you've been involved.
When I first got started, much longer ago than I care to admit, we were dealing mainly with sightings. The objects in the air, maybe close to the ground, maybe landed on the ground, very few reports of the creatures from inside. One of the best, and I remember this, one of the sightings that just garnered international news and was so exciting that it was on the CBS Evening News, was the Lonnie Zamora sighting in April of 1964. And this is because here's a police officer sees a thing on the ground and saw two humanoids with it, and it's one of the few cases in the Project Blue Book files labeled as unidentified that has occupants involved with it. But mostly the objects were close to the ground in the air. It evolved in 1973 to an awful lot of the objects seen on the ground, the creatures seen outside gathering samples, and a number of abduction reports. Prior to 1973 in the 1970s, we didn't have a lot of abduction reports. We had Barney and Betty Hill. We had the South American lawyer, whose name for some reason escapes me at the moment.
And me too.
But we had those two reports and virtually nothing else. But after the 1973 wave, we began to getting more and more abduction reports. And suddenly, abductions have become a very large part of the UFO arena. We also started in the 70s with the cattle mutilations, which is another large subset of the UFO phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So what has happened is we had UFO sightings and suddenly we're splintered in all these various factions. Cattle mutilations, alien abductions, MJ-12, the Roswell case, and very
crop
few people.
Crop circles.
Yes, crop circles. All fracturing the UFO field and taking resources into those various arenas, and very, very little being done on current sightings, because an object seen in the air isn't quite as exciting as an abduction report or a landing trace case in the form of a crop circle left behind. So we've moved off into all these factions of ufology, and we have no real cohesive whole now. And then we have the infighting amongst all the various factions. The crop circle people don't like the animal mutilation people, who don't like the abduction people, who don't like everybody. I don't know. It's gotten very contentious in the UFO field, with everybody guarding their own turf and no real cooperation amongst the various factions, and no real scientific methodology used consistently throughout the UFO phenomenon. We turn things on their heads. We say, well, so-and-so said he was abducted. Prove he wasn't. Not our job. Your job is to prove he was abducted, not our job to prove he wasn't. And so we turn science on its head. We sneer at science frequently, even though scientific methodology would probably be something that would help us understand what's going on much better than all this infighting. And if we kind of all agreed to use scientific methodology, then we'd have sort of a common language to talk. But we don't do that. So we're just fragmented. We go back and we have to reinvestigate old cases endlessly to find out new information, and rarely is there new information. And when we grow tired of that, then we can go start fooling around in the Bermuda Triangle, I guess.
Well, I think the Bermuda Triangle has pretty much been taken care of as far as escaping huge amounts of gas escaping from the seabed and rising up and causing enormous bubbles to appear in the water surface. And, of course, ships don't float on gas. They float on water.
I think if you take a look at Lawrence Kusch's book, The Bermuda Triangle Solved, I think his explanation is brilliant in its simplicity, which most of the disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle didn't really happen under the mysterious circumstances that are claimed. If you go back to the original sources and the original newspaper articles, you find out that things have somehow been twisted or facts have gotten lost. And one of the best examples of that is I was an intelligence officer for the 928th Tactical Airlift Group, whose parent organization was the 440th Tactical Airlift Wing in Milwaukee, which lost a C-119 flying boxcar in the Bermuda Triangle. So I'm assigned to the unit, so I think, well, you know, I can go talk to the guys, find out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and talked to the guys to find out what happened, and they had a very logical explanation for it, and they said, and wreckage was found, and they said, you want to see some of it? And I said, yeah. So they took me down and showed me some of the wreckage that had been found. So it wasn't a mysterious disappearance in the Bermuda Triangle. It was a tragic aircraft accident. So when you look at the original information, you get that. And then there are some very mysterious disappearances that this idea of these great belches of gas from the ocean floor that have been documented could easily swamp a ship and turn it over and sink it in a matter of minutes before the crew had any chance to react or call for help.
Yes, and apparently also methane gas could knock down airplanes if the airplanes happened to fly into a cloud of it.
It would shut down the engine. I think there was an experiment that they showed on the History Channel or National Geographic or somewhere where they had an operating engine and they blew a cloud of gas at the engine and it stalled it. If you're a little bit uncoordinated, you may not be able to get your aircraft engine started again. You fall into the ocean. And airplanes are not designed to float.
No. No. And often there won't be any signs of any wreckage at all of an aircraft that hits the water.
If it doesn't break up on contact, there may not be any signs of it. And even if it does break up somewhat, all that you might be able to find would be an oil slick. And if the seas are choppy, the oil slick may not last all that long.
To go back a moment to the interest initially in UFOs, presumably back in the early days of UFO study, the interest was much more in the objects themselves than what might be operating them. And you figured that started to change, what, in 1973, you said?
There was always some discussion about alien creatures, but those sorts of reports were very few and far between. You didn't have a lot of those things. You had the objects in the sky. You might have them close to ground. You might have aircraft intercepts. The Washington Nationals, when the UFOs were seen over Washington, D.C. on two consecutive Saturday nights in 1952, and you had jet fighters intercepting the objects. You had things like that going on. So there's interaction between the objects and the Air Force, for example. But you had very few cases of the creatures from inside being seen outside. You had some, but not very many. In the 1960s, you got a few more, but in 1973, you got lots of them. There was a base from, I think, around the middle of September to around the first or second week in November 1973. Awful lot of UFO sightings, awful lot of reports of the things on the ground, awful lot of reports of the creatures outside gathering samples. And it just struck me as you read those reports that if we, were the alien creatures and we'd gone to another world that was inhabited and we didn't want to interact with the inhabitants, that we may engage in that sort of surreptitious gathering of samples. And we would gather as much information as we possibly could, not analyze it at the time, but just gather the stuff, the samples, and get the hell out of there, which seemed to be what happened in 1973. There were a number of abduction reports as well. Hickson and Park in Pascagoula, Mississippi, for example. There were other reports of abductions I think are explainable in the more mundane, but this seemed to mark a point where we began to get an awful lot of creature reports. And after that, we began to pick up more and more abduction reports. Along around 1973, and I'm not saying that's a definitive point, but this is where it seems that we began to branch off into some of the other arenas.
Do you lend any credence to the stories of the various arms of the military being ordered to shoot on sight flying objects that they didn't recognize, to shoot them down?
Well, in today's environment, I know that we operate under very strict rules of engagement. In the United States, we operate under rules for the use of force, which means very strictly controlled when we can use force, how much force we can use, given the jobs we have to do. For example, if a National Guard unit is required to evacuate civilians from an area, from a disaster area, the rules under which we can order them out are very, very limited. We don't have a lot of discretionary power in that. And so when we look back on this thing, I have heard and seen information that suggests the orders were to bring down a flying saucer if they could. But I think that what you have to look at is, and you're operating with other things in mind, one of which is they're violating our airspace, and we can look at what's happened when the Soviet Union, for example, violated the coastal defense zones. And were there aircraft that penetrated the United States shot down? Rarely. They were escorted out. The Soviet Union fired on our reconnaissance aircraft. We can look at the world stage and see that the Israelis have shot down airliners by mistake. The Soviet Union has done the same thing. The United States has done the same thing. So there's always that possibility. And I had heard, and I want to say that there is documentation to back it up, that at one point there were orders to bring down a flying saucer if they could. But those orders have long since been rescinded because you open yourself up to interpretations of what is a UFO and when should we fire upon it, that sort of thing. So that discretion is taken away somewhat, which is a long-winded way, I guess, of saying I'm not really sure.
Okay. Yeah. I had Frank Fascino on the program a couple of weeks ago, both he and Stan Friedman. Frank has a new book coming out called Shoot 'Em Down. Both he and Stan have been looking into the early 1950s, right around the time of the Washington flaps. There apparently have been incidents of aircraft, actually, I think they said about 40 of them, that had either run out of fuel or had mechanical failures or flown into mountains from around that time. And the basis of Frank's book is the orders to shoot these things down, which were apparently eventually rescinded when the feeling was that they were losing too many aircraft and better to make gun camera pictures than actually physically shoot these things down because there would be retaliation.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that we really have the technology to bring them down, especially in 1952.
Right.
And second of all, flying is an inherently dangerous occupation. There's all kinds of things that can go wrong to bring down an aircraft. So the fact that a pilot has made an error, I mean, we just had a Blue Angel killed in an aircraft accident, last weekend. And they reported that since 1947, 24 of the Blue Angels have been killed in aircraft accidents.
And they're ace pilots.
They're supposedly the best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also doing highly dangerous maneuvers, flying very close to the ground at very high speeds.
And very close to each other, too. Yeah.
Yes. So there is no margin for error. You screw up and you usually turn into a flaming ball of wreckage. So the fact that airplanes have crashed and been lost, I'm not convinced is a result of alien enemy action. I know that his book, he talked about the 1952 sighting in West Virginia and that a large number of aircraft had been engaged in a dogfight with UFOs. And I just find this extremely difficult to believe.
I don't know one way or the other, and I'm seeking guests' opinions to see if they know anything. I haven't read Frank's book. It's not out yet. It will be very shortly. And it'll be an interesting read, and it'll be interesting to get the field's reaction to it, too.
You can pretty well predict the field's reaction. There's going to be the true believers on one hand who are going to accept it all as the gospel, and you're going to have the debunkers at the other end who wouldn't believe it if the damn things fell on them. Then you'll have opinion ranging from, well, yeah, I don't know for sure, it sounds plausible, to, well, I don't know for sure, but it sounds implausible. So unless he has some very credible documentation and some very credible evidence, it's going to be hard to accept this stuff. It's the problem we run into with Roswell. We have some very, very good testimony from some very credible people, but we have very little in the way of documentation that leads us to the extraterrestrial. Yeah, we can prove something fell at Roswell. We can prove that the military reacted to it. We can prove that the reaction was extraordinary, the lengths they went to bury the information, but that doesn't necessarily prove it was extraterrestrial. And that's something that I think too much of the UFO community forgets is, yes, Roswell is very interesting, but when you get right down to the evidence, all we have is the testimony, and some of it leads us to the extraterrestrial and some of it doesn't. And so we don't have what would be considered the extraordinary evidence to make the claim that Roswell was extraterrestrial. And when we get into things like the Air Force engaging in dogfights with UFOs, we're going to have some very persuasive evidence in the form of documentation. And we have Thomas Mantell, who was killed chasing a flying saucer in 1948. And I think pretty much throughout the UFO community, it's accepted now that he wasn't chasing a flying saucer. He was chasing something else, but the cause of the accident was his mistake in not using or climbing too high without oxygen equipment on board his aircraft. And what I found extraordinary as I was doing some research on this is how quickly you lose consciousness when you get above 15 or 16,000 feet. You have to be very careful when you get to those altitudes. The Air Force regulations say above 14,000 feet you're required to go on oxygen. Well, Mantell was up at 20,000 feet trying to get closer to this thing, and he told his wingman, I'm going to go to 25,000 feet and I'll circle for 10 minutes, and if I can't get any closer, I'll break off the chase. Well, when you look at the studies of how much useful consciousness you have at 25,000 feet, it's something like 3 minutes. So even had he not been goofing around at 20,000 feet for a while, he didn't have 10 minutes to fly around at 25,000 feet before he lost consciousness. And it's pretty clear what happened is he trimmed the aircraft to climb as he was going to 25,000 feet. He lost consciousness. The aircraft, due to torque and the thinning of the atmosphere, pulled over around 30,000 feet into a power dive and broke up about 19,000 feet because it couldn't handle the stresses. Mm-hmm. Mantell made a very tragic mistake.
Yes.
So the question is, was he chasing an honest-to-God flying saucer, or was he chasing something else? Well, the consensus seems to be he was chasing something else of terrestrial origin. So we don't have a flying saucer in this story anymore. We have a tragic aircraft accident. So there are instances where pilots have been killed in what originally was a UFO response, but in the end it wasn't an extraterrestrial craft.
The case that really stands out in my mind in Air Force pilots chasing UFOs is the Felix Moncla incident over Lake Superior, where he was vectored in on a very large radar blip, which was seen from several different radar vantage points. The small blip that was his aircraft and the very large unidentified blip merged, and then the next sweep of the radar, they were gone, and Moncla was never heard from again.
And interestingly, I talked to a couple of pilots who were assigned to that Air Force base at the time.
Ah.
And one of them, who was a lieutenant colonel, told me there were two schools of thought. Was one that Moncla had gone into Lake Superior, that went straight in, the aircraft didn't break up, and there was no oil slick. And the other school of thought was that it got it, whatever it was. And so here's a very mysterious case that we still don't have a solution for.
No.
The aircraft is missing. Moncla and his backseat radar officer, I think his name was Wilson, have disappeared. They haven't been heard from since 1953, I think it was, November of 53.
Mm-hmm.
So here are two pilots who were again killed chasing a UFO. And in this case, I think the UFO we don't know what it was. We don't know whether it was extraterrestrial. We don't know if it was terrestrial. I know that the Air Force tried to blame the Canadians at one point.
I know, and the Canadian pilot swore up and down he was 100 miles away from there.
Yeah, and if I had been the Canadian and I wasn't there, I would have done the exact same thing. No, you guys aren't pinning this on me.
Yeah.
So they tried a number of solutions that haven't worked, and all we can say in the end is the people who were there on the base are split about what happened. Clearly, Moncla and Wilson are gone. The aircraft is missing. No one knows what happened, and there was an unidentified blip on the radar to suggest something else going on.
And maybe we'll never know what the something else was.
But you say that, and I think back of the loss of the Stardust. If you remember, it was a BOAC aircraft that disappeared flying to Santiago, Chile.
Yes.
And the last word they ever sent was Stendek. Nobody has yet to figure out what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
But then we look back, and it was 6 or 7 years ago that the wreckage was found.
Yes.
It'd flown into a mountain.
And come out of a glacier.
Well, it had flown into the glacier in a snowstorm, and the aircraft was covered up by the snow, and everybody thought that the aircraft had gone down close to Santiago, Chile, because the radio operator had said that they were about 5 minutes out, and the thing vanishes at that point. So where the hell did it go? Well, they had not gotten as far as they thought they had in the flight, and they were still in the mountains when they began the letdown to go into Santiago, Chile, and flew into a mountain. But we did get an answer, except for what the hell Stendek means.
Yes.
We still haven't figured that, except that our good friends from the Allende letters told us that Stendek was really a garbled transmission of the word stand back. Of course, Allende not realizing that it wasn't voice that they were using, but actually Morris. So that explanation didn't work, which is suggests another reason that the Allende letters aren't worth anything.
They had actually sent Morse code sending Stendek.
Yes. Three times he sent it.
Wow.
Because the operator in the tower didn't understand what it meant.
Mm.
Unless the operator in the tower wrote the thing down and just misheard it the same way three times, which is possible. You get it in your mind that he sent it Stendek, and it came out that way two more times, so you don't know what the hell he meant.
Yeah, that's an interesting I hadn't heard, stand back.
Yes, that comes from the Allende letters,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. There are just so many mysteries people try to tie in with UFOs, and they're mysterious enough by themselves without bringing UFOs into the equation.
With the Stardust, there was no reason to bring the UFOs into it. It's just an aircraft that disappeared, mysteriously disappeared. How can an airplane disappear that close to landing at the airfield? And the answer is they weren't that close to the airfield. And we now know because the wreckage has been found. And serial numbers from the wreckage have been confirmed, and I think DNA analysis have identified some of the people killed, so we know where the airplane is. We know what happened to it. But for 50 years, it was a mystery. What happened to the airplane? Well, now we know.
We have had, over the years, and not since the 1940s and Foo Fighters, but strange objects in the skies go back way, way back, I mean, into biblical times, but also as recently as the 1800s. There were a lot of things going on in the skies in the 1800s when there were no airplanes.
Absolutely correct. And one of the biggest waves of UFO sightings was the Great Airship of 1897. And what's interesting about this is those sightings tend to mirror everything that's happened or is happening in the modern UFO era. There are abductions, there are cattle mutilations, there are crashes, there are just strange sightings of strange creatures. All of it in the Great Airship of 1897, which I think, and Jerry Clark and I have actually argued about this a little bit, he thinks there's a solid core of sightings to the 1897 airships. I think that it was all pretty much generated myth from the times as the newspapers and radio telegraphers were having a great deal of fun. We've just seen, again, a rekindling of interest in the Aurora, Texas UFO crash.
Yeah.
The object was seen flying near Aurora, Texas, hit a windmill that belonged to Judge Proctor and exploded, killing the pilot, which, of course, the locals thought came from Mars. They apparently had nothing else to do that day, so they engaged in a funeral for the pilot and buried him in the local graveyard, and then cleaned up all the debris, which has now vanished into the wilderness. I think this kind of shows us what we need to do in the way of research is, if you look at it, you can find the initial stories of the crash, but you never find any follow-up stories, nothing that tells you more what happened, which suggests it may have been a hoax. You look at the names of the people involved. They talk about a Signal Corps officer named T.J. Weems, making some pronouncement about what the craft was. And back in that era, the turn of the last century, Signal Corps kind of talked about it, was kind of the intelligence function in the U.S. Army at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking Signal Corps officer, you're thinking intelligence officer. But T.J. Weems turned out to be the local blacksmith, had no connection with the military. Now, in the early 1970s, I actually went to Aurora, Texas, because I was stationed in Texas, and I thought, well, it's not all that far from my house, so I drove on up there and talked to the people in Wise County, Aurora being in Wise County, Texas. And the Historical Society said, nah, nothing like that happened here. We don't know what you're talking about. Talk to some of the people, the very same people who later on said, yes, yes, it was all true, told me, no, it never happened. It was just a myth. If you take a look, there's a couple of books that were written around the turn of the last century, one in 1908 that was a sort of a history of Wise County. Well, this is like 11 years after the event took place. And you're thinking, well, if this happened, there would be a lot of people talking about it 11 years later. Not one word of it in the history of Wise County. So you have to ask yourself, well, why not? Why wasn't there anything there? And we take a look at a lot of the airship stories, and we find out that they were made up by the locals who signed affidavits attesting to their veracity until something happened and you realized they were having you on. There was a case in Waterloo, Iowa, where the thing landed in the fairgrounds, and for 2 days there was all this interest in it, people coming by to see this strange contraption, and they were feeling bad because the leader of the expedition had been killed when he fell overboard and drowned in the Cedar River. Until somebody finally recognized them as local men. And then they confessed it was all a hoax, and they dismantled their airship and went home. There were landings in Texas where the people said, yeah, I talked to the pilots. They're on the way to Cuba to bomb the Spaniards, because this was just prior to the Spanish-American War, and there was an awful lot of hostility between the Spanish and Cuba and the United States at the time. So we have all those sorts of things going on, but there's rarely any follow-up. One of the best stories that came out of that was the calf napping from Alexander Hamilton's farm in Kansas. And he talked about how they woke up late at night and they heard the calf bawling, and they went out and they saw this huge airship in the sky, and there was a rope from the airship down around the calf, and it was caught in a barbed wire fence, and they clipped it out of the barbed wire fence, and the airship and the calf all took off. And the next day they found the mutilated remains of the calf in a field with no footprints around it. And here's this very mysterious story, and Alexander Hamilton told it, and all his friends signed affidavits talking about the veracity of it. And the question becomes, where's the follow-up the next day? Where's the subsequent stories about this? Nothing ever appeared until two things happened. Jerry Clark interviewed, I think it was a daughter of Alexander Hamilton in the 1970s, and she said, yeah, it was all a great joke. Her dad and the local Liars Club had made it up. And then Eddie Bullard went through a number of Kansas newspapers and could find no confirmation of it until he came to the Yates County Advocate, or I forget the name of the newspaper, talking about how they had invented the story, that it was all just done and for great fun. So we now know that that story, which has been reprinted endlessly in UFO books as if it is authentic, and at the time some of the books were written to be fair, it seemed to be authentic. But this kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier, how we have to keep revisiting things. And now we have to go back and explain, yeah, the great airship stories. Well, this one was explained, and this wasn't explained, and this one was explained. And it's not helpful that you have the History Channel and Discovery Channel doing documentaries on this stuff. I know on UFO Updates there's been complaints about how documentarians always run immediately to the skeptical side, and everything is skeptical, and we need some good pro-UFO documentaries, and yet I've seen pro-UFO documentaries talking about the validity of the Aurora, Texas crash. We know what went on there. We know that it was a hoax, and yet they're still talking about exhuming the body of the alien who's buried there, and yet the records for the cemetery exist, and there's no grave for the alien. All the graves in the cemetery are accounted for, because somebody went back and looked to make sure of that sort of thing. But that sort of evidence is overlooked. Instead, we're now trying to dig up wreckage from the flying saucer crash in 1897.
Yes. So your feeling is that, what, all of those airship stories are hoaxes?
I'm reluctant to say all of them, although
I understand, yeah.
Although that's the direction I'm leaning. As I said, you know, Jerry Clark and I kind of argued this point. Some of the stuff started in November of 1896, and he thinks there's a solid core that kind of generated the idea, and then all these other people in 1897, in March and April of 1897, kind of jumped on the bandwagon and started talking about these things, and so the newspapers began generating the stories. And in fact, as another example of how things never change, I think it was in Burlington, Iowa, the reporters of the local newspaper launched a hot air balloon with candles in it. You know, the old laundry bag with the candles in it that generated UFO sightings for a while?
Garbage bags, yes.
Yes, well, they did that in 1897, and you read the stories, and some of the reporters are very distressed to learn that one of the town's most prominent citizens who sighted this thing also claimed that he heard voices coming from it, speaking a foreign language. Well, they knew what it was because they'd launched the darn balloon. But the point simply is, nothing ever changes. 1897, they're launching balloons with candles in them, hot air balloons, to fake UFO sightings. And we have the same thing today.
And it all, of course, gets in the way of the real thing.
Yeah, the signal-to-noise ratio is just terrible. We have very little signal and an awful lot of noise. And then we end up with these ancillary things like cattle mutilations and crop circles and abductions and MJ-12 and all of this creating more and more noise while we're trying to find this very precise signal. So I guess in some ways we should be sympathetic to the SETI people who are looking for one intelligent signal and all that radio noise floating around in the universe.
When you think of all the money that's being poured into SETI and them looking for a needle in thousands of haystacks, how useful it could have been, along with the scientific minds that were involved with that, investigating what we know already has been here.
I've often wondered why SETI is so rabidly anti-UFO. You would think if there was one UFO sighting, legitimate, real-life, honest-to-God, extraterrestrial craft, that SETI would suddenly be much more important.
Well, you would think so, but it's like when some researchers are asked, will they ever find a cure for cancer? And the answer is probably not, because there are too many people who would lose their livelihoods who are into finding a cure for cancer.
But on the other side, we're finding vaccines for some cancers, finding cures for some cancers.
Some of them, yes.
And when you say find a cure for cancer, the problem is there's not just one kind of cancer.
Understood.
There's all these other kinds of cancers.
I'm just saying, well, if something were to land on the White House lawn and it was proved that they were from elsewhere, that would put the SETI people out of business.
Not necessarily, because if there's one, then there must be more, and let's look for them. And now we know that there are other intelligence out there. And I think that thing, and I haven't got it up on my blog yet, Julie, just in the last couple of days reported an Earth-sized planet not all that far from our solar system.
Yes.
And so now suddenly we're finding 220 extrasolar planets have been found.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the 1960s, when Frank Drake came up with his formula for determining whether we were alone in the universe or not, we didn't know whether there were actually planets around other stars. We thought there probably were, but we didn't know. Now we know there are. Now we found planets with water in their atmosphere, which means one of what we believe to be the components of life is available to these extrasolar planets. So it's becoming much more likely there's other intelligent life in our galaxy than it was in 1960 because of the discovery. So I'm thinking that if we found out that there was aliens visited Earth, then SETI would have all this influx of money to say, hey, yeah, find out where they are. Let's see what's going on out there. See what we can determine about them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know they're out there now. We're not guessing they're out there. We know they're out there.
Yes. Well, one would think that with the number of potentially populated planets that they've come up with in the recent years, that SETI would spend most of their time aiming their radio telescopes in those general directions.
And here's something else. I know there was an argument at one point about Zeta 1, Zeta 2 reticuli not being able to have planets because double stars didn't have planets until they determined that they weren't a double star. But I think one of the extrasolar planets they found is now in a double star system, and they said the suns that you saw in Star Wars.
Mm.
Tatooine, whatever the name of the planet was, you had the two double stars setting in the distance. Now it's plausible because they found a planet in a system that had two suns. So being a double star does not negate the possibility of having planets. So now we've expanded the numbers even further. It doesn't have to be a single star. It can be a double star. And I think they've even found one in a triple star system. But somebody had asked the question, somewhere, why are we looking for these extrasolar planets and all these other places? Why not at Alpha Centauri, which is the closest star to Earth, excepting the Sun, of course? And the answer may be, well, it's a triple star system, and we're looking at other stars where we can detect the wobble and we can detect the planets. It goes in all those directions.
You mentioned your blog, and perhaps we should give out the URL for it, Kevin, and then I will also put it in the program listing so people can go and read the interesting things that you write there.
Okay, well, the blog is at www.kevinrandall, all one word, and it's Randall, R-A-N-D-L-E, .blogspot.com.
It's a blog that I visit, and I don't visit too many of them on a regular basis. I leave that sort of thing to Stuart Miller.
And now that I've moved into the broadband arena, now that I've moved into the 21st century from dial-up, I can get my pictures embedded a lot easier, and I can do a lot more things with the blog than I used to be able to do. So
good, good.
Periodically, more and more interesting things are showing up.
And I look forward to seeing those more interesting things. And I want to thank you for being with us on this program, Kevin Randall. It's always good to talk with you.
And it's always fun to talk with you.
I know you're going off to do military-type things in the next couple of weeks. And as we say in showbiz, break a leg there.
Which would get me out of doing those military-type things.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye, Kevin. Thanks.
Thank you.
Every couple of weeks, Alfred Lemberg joins us here on SDI. And this program, well, it happens to be a couple of weeks since he was last on. So down there in Alabama, here's Alfred Lemberg.
Down, 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 down.
Nicely done.
with echoes and theremin music. In
the yeah.
Background.
And a little whammy bar there, too, eh, Alfred?
Hey, it was a superior program this week. I really enjoyed it. Some very good conversation. Conversational journalistic stuff, you know, very interesting to listen to. Dr. Randall and Mr. Woods, this iteration, you're to be commended once again. If I can't get effusive enough with my accolades for SDI itself. Huh? There are a couple of things that Dr. Randall brought up. Some of the more quotable quotes or turns of phrases that Dr. Randall had this time were instructive and amusing and in some cases not a little inspiring. For instance, he had some very interesting things that he was talking about vis-a-vis his take on Don Eckert. He mentioned that in some cases, and I really kind of got the impression that the doctor was trying to give Don Eckert every benefit of the doubt with regard to his contribution to ufology, given his leaving and what have you,
mm-hmm.
that things get lost, and this is a quote, things get lost in the filtering processes as they're writ down sometimes. Do you remember him saying that?
I do, yes. And he's absolutely right.
Yes. And he said something else, too, which was kind of interesting, that we all think we hear things and we don't hear them quite right and we get things slightly wrong, splintered into ufological factions and his fracturings to the field. And other interesting turns of phrase that he used were taking resources from what, I wonder, and putting them where, I wonder, and that there is infighting and turf guarding and no cooperation and no cohesive whole, he said. No scientific methodology used throughout, he said. Okay, I can appreciate that, but where does the fault for that actually lie? Another item that Dr. Randall brought up that was kind of interesting, Roswell and Bessie Brazel was brought up, and she's key to a couple of things here, actually, because what the discussion is that Dr. Randall is concerned with revisiting of details and offered reasons why this unfortunate revisiting of details would be going on at all. And he allowed, as it was probably because somebody new comes into the field and they're not really read into what's going on a particular subject that's being discussed or even the particular question that they might ask. And this keys directly into the UFO Updates Archive being used as a searchable database to preclude this kind of needless wheel spinning. But I have to hearken back to this revisiting of details. There's many examples of this revisiting of details in Roswell, revisiting details in Trinidad, revisiting Kecksburg details, MJ-12 details, Betty and Barney Hill details. It goes on and on and on, and the same questions are asked over and over and over again. Because someone new comes into the field? I think not in many, many cases. I think that sometimes it's those niggling details are gone over again and again and again is to generate a discredit for that item being discussed. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when I wrote on, and this is a couple of years ago now, so maybe you don't remember, but I got into a tiff with Rimmer over Betty and Barney Hill and there being a racial component to that. And he challenged me for details. Do you remember that at all?
With John Rimmer?
Mm-hmm.
Vague memories of it, yes.
I didn't really get what his problem was. What was under discussion, really, was this phenomena that I termed a locker rupture. And what that means is, basically, in high school when we were kids, and if you didn't pack everything in your gym locker so it couldn't be grabbed from the outside, what the tiniest little thread would be weeded and threaded out of the space between the door and the casing of the locker, and your gym shorts or gym shirt or your shoes even were jerked out to the point where it destroyed the locker. Harkening back to that generating discredit for items under discussion by constantly bringing up these little details and going over them again and again and again is that same thing. It's locker rupture. John Rimmer and I had this little Donnybrook based over my contention that there was a racial component to the Betty and Barney Hill case that was being used to help discredit the whole thing. And when he called me on it, and I didn't respond with an immediate answer, he smelled blood in the water and attacked, you know, again, on these details to the point where, you know, I was finally able to understand what he was talking about and what his problem was. He just wanted some examples of it. So I nailed him with four or five vetted citations, validating my whole argument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would think, okay, problem solved. But no. Did he concede the point for the record? No, he did not. See, he didn't make it right. He went silent, ostensibly, so the similar wheel spin could be done further on down the road, I'm offering. Again, back to that point of why do we keep going over the details? Well, we keep going over the details, I think, so they can be discredited in the microcosm, so the whole ufological macrocosm can be discredited.
That's an interesting take.
Well, it's what you're paying me for, Earl.
Yeah.
You did mention UFO Watchdog favorably.
Oh, absolutely. And UFO Watchdog needs to be constantly mentioned and favorably.
Well, hey, you're not going to get any argument from me.
Those of us that
I think it was a great
voice.
Reference and a needed one, like you say. You know, he's having some problems with our favorite expatriate, Cal K. Korf. Set things in motion for a lawsuit against Royce Myers at UFO Watchdog.
Yeah, there have been lots of people who have instigated or threatened to instigate, and only one person actually has brought a lawsuit, and that was Sean David Morton, who's a shyster, and it was tossed.
Yeah, wasn't he not able to substantiate any of his claims?
That's the way it seemed to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of way it seems
yeah.
to me, too.
Yeah, yeah.
We agree, it must be fact.
Yes.
You know, one thing I thought was kind of unfortunate was Dr. Randall's attitude and take on the abduction phenomena.
I didn't want to get into it with him because he and I disagree on that. And I'm sure that many, many abductees disagree with Kevin Randall on that.
On the part of abductions, I would be a lot less interested in them myself if they didn't have such a ready history that goes back with similar interactions between ourselves and an other all through history. And, you know, all manners of different people are writing and talking about that, from Jacques Vallée to Terence McKenna, Rick Strassman to, the list kind of goes on and on and on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
More people writing about it all the time.
Jeremy Vaney, who was on here a couple of weeks ago.
And I think has kind of a very interesting and artistic take on this whole thing that I really appreciate and resonate to, if you haven't fingered that out.
Yeah.
I think he's a very impressive young man. And makes some film with some pretty good production values on a shoestring budget, too. I think he may be one of those Steven Spielbergs in the round, you know?
I haven't seen his doc, but I understand that it's quite a different way of putting something together that he's come up with.
Very compelling stuff.
Yeah.
And watchable again and again, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
Even the bumpy bits that are kind of hard to sit through, you see something new in them every time you look at them.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's just me. Another thing on Dr. Randall, Frank Fascino and his new book, Shoot Them Down. Now, for my money, I think The Good Doctor was commenting a little bit upon that which he is not informed. And I think he could have couched his commentary a little bit because, I mean, who can say what would be necessary given the overnight emplacements of new weapons on aircraft that was not predicted to do just exactly this kind of thing that conceivably could have taken an alien craft by surprise. And, man, when you get drilled by a 2.75 folding fin aerial rocket, let's see, they called it Mighty Mouse missiles. These things can ruin your whole day, you know.
If you don't have the force field up, you're in deep doo.
And again, if you don't have that force field up, you are in deep doo. His commentary did not take into account just how many persons were lost and equipment destroyed in this exercise that general officers in command are quoted as saying hundreds of sorties and much equipment and lives lost. And these are the guys in charge, you know, notwithstanding what Donald Kehoe is writing about the subject, notwithstanding anything that's written from Maccabee through Richard Hall to Stanton Friedman, the interactions with our military and UFOs during that summer of 1952 when all the stuff was going on. Also, he didn't really address how long this shoot-down order might have been in effect. There is some evidence that it could have been in effect over periods of more years than months. There is a lot of evidence from Dr. Maccabee and Mr. Friedman and others that corroborates what Frank is saying, given what Robert Hastings has talked about for years himself in college lectures. And then there's Richard Dolan, who kind of corroborates Fascino, too. So, boy, I'll tell you what, the jury is in no way out on Frank Fascino. And seriously, the man and his work deserves a really hard look,
mm-hmm.
in my estimation.
And I'm really looking forward to giving it a hard look.
It seems I may be detecting a sea change with Dr. Randall a little bit. I interviewed him many years ago now. And we were talking about Roswell and many of the things that he had to say about Roswell and what his feelings were on some of the witnesses in Roswell. When it's all said and done, and I gave the question straight out and really tried to nail him down, okay, now come on, Doc, you know, in your estimation, is there an alien intelligence, an ET involvement with this thing? And he gave me an unequivocal yes. I don't know if you detected the same thing, but I'm getting the distinct impression that he may be reevaluating his position on that a little bit, and I have to ask him the question myself. In his estimation, after his hard look, after his academic interest in this, and, you know, all things considered and all things being taken into account there, bottom line, Doc, do UFOs reflect a genuine reality, or are they an activity of credulous fools? If you had to come down on one side or the other, which side do you want to come down? And what's your take on that, on where he is? Is he up or down on E.T., do you think?
My feeling is that he has always been up on E.T. rather than down.
Mm-hmm. Even in this last interview with him?
I still feel the same.
Uh-huh. Maybe I was reading too much into it.
Perhaps.
He did mention one thing, though. He said when you're looking at evidence and what you're really kind of looking for is some kind of follow-up after the fact to give a good solid indication on whether it's a hoax or not. And my question is that maybe no follow-up after something extraordinary like that happening is really a signal of something twitchy has been encountered, and the persons involved are reluctant to deal with it. Do you think that's fair?
I don't know. I try and be sort of middle groundy about most of the things that I do. There are some things that I come out and very pointedly make my views known.
Oh, yeah.
But for the most part, I'm a fence sitter. Always have been. Except with my own experiences, and then I'm really absolutely convinced.
Dr. Randall mentioned that there was a lot of noise and little signal.
You and I have also commented on that, either privately or in public.
Yes, and the only place or spot that we may diverge is why. Why is that happening? Why is there a lot of noise and little signal? And I touched a little bit on this in my 20 questions for SDI 437 this week. Why? Why is there so much noise and so little signal?
Since you asked the question, most of that is caused by newcomers. Most of it. And then there is a little undercurrent of disinformation, and some of those newcomers are deliberately planted there. That's my feeling on it.
I think it was Don Eckert who had quoted or paraphrased and said that with regard to ufology, the inmates have taken over the asylum. What are the mechanics of taking over the asylum? In the first place, are they allowed to take over the asylum? Is it because that there was nothing there? Is it because the doctors and the leadership and officialdom has abdicated their responsibility to do something responsible in that area? And I'm thinking, okay, a lot of noise, little signal. There's a lot of noise because there is not a good signal. When there should be a good signal, that culture and society should step up and actually try to grab this bull by the horns and really face it head on and get to the bottom of it, because I think that there's a lot of benefit for humanity on the other side of doing something like that, or I wouldn't be as passionate, I guess, as I am about it.
Yes. How about Mike Woods and his space report?
Really good news for the pessimists, that he noticed out there, and the discovery of new planets. It does take 400,000 years to get there, and a red dwarf is likely going to be providing the wrong kind of light to grow the plants that we need to exist up there.
If it hadn't died by the time we got there.
Yeah, even seeds would be hard-pressed in the rigors of space. His mention of the visiting queen to Goddard at NASA.
Yes.
Goddard at NASA and other rebellious swine. I love that. I love that
yeah.
stuff. Except we kicked their butts at Yorktown, I can tell you. But notwithstanding.
Yeah, but then you got your butts kicked up here, so it all evens
true,
out.
That's true. Okay. All right. Well, I demand a rematch.
Some Canada-U.S. history, folks.
But some of the other nifty turns of phrases that Woodsy was using, I loved his heavy-lifting intellectual poindexters. When he was talking about an actual science fiction item made real in the real world, deflector shields, is that not some astonishing stuff or what? An interesting concept, reduced carbon footprints. I really liked that. And ways to reduce that carbon footprint by building huge space umbrellas, by deliberately putting the same kind of stuff in the air that a volcano would put in the air. Iron salting of the oceans, looking for a green algae bloom to suck up some of that carbon dioxide and what have you. Sounds like great stuff, and it's the kind of stuff that we were reading actually in the 30s and the 40s when we were going to be able to use our grand technology to save our butts in any and all ways. You know, science marches on. But what we discover subsequently is that, buddy, if you screw with a butterfly's wing beat in any shape or manner or fashion, it's like you are going to knock that butterfly out of the air. If you try to control the butterfly yourself, you are not going to be able to fly. And if we build these space umbrellas, and if we put deliberate volcanoes into use, if we start iron salting the oceans, good Lord, consider the repercussions of moving one piece on the board of our ecology, that when you move one piece on the board, every other piece is affected. We got to be more careful what we're doing, I think.
And that's this week's ecological message from Alfred Lemberg.
Da-da-da-da. I'm relieved and pleased and proud that I am able to contribute the Mars rovers to world history, and that they are indeed, as Mr. Woods said, the pinnacle of human engineering.
Just astounding that those things are still working up there.
Oh, consider, they're at the cutting edge of our sensibility, and they are at the absolute extent, furthest of our reach, where we can actually reach out and touch something in a manner of like drilling into it and performing experiments on it. Well, I'll tell you, when science is good, science is really good. You know, unfortunately, though, that when science is bad, science is really bad. The ever-happening interactions with UFOs, this is another point that Mr. Woods brought up, the point that they get photographed, they leave trace cases, they provide multiple witnesses, there are radar corroborations, and there are disparate witness cases where witnesses who are not in contact with each other are reporting the same thing. Just another indication that, folks, there's something out there. When you guys were talking about what occurred at O'Hare and that strange craft, whatever it was, punching a hole in the clouds in such a unique and remarkable manner, and that this is given the discounted testimony from dozens of persons out there who see aircraft, our aircraft, punch in and out of clouds all day, all the time. And that testimony is discounted. Another smoking gun there, I think.
Seems like it. And airplanes, our aircraft, don't punch through. They slide through.
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. One final correction I have to make to something that Mr. Wood said, his discussion of Greenland and Iceland and how they got their names. They went somewhere and it was green, so they called it Greenland. And they went somewhere and it was covered with ice and they called it Iceland. Generally, that's kind of what he was saying. The point there is that I had read in more than one spot that calling Greenland Greenland was a hoax perpetrated by the discoverers because they wanted to get people to go up there so they wouldn't go to Iceland where it was really green, and that's why it was named Iceland. Had you ever heard that?
No, I hadn't. And a nice catch.
I've heard that a couple of places, and if anybody can shoot me down on it, I would really appreciate it.
Alfred Lindberg, Kerr of SDI at virtuallystrange.net.
And summing up with Mr. Woods, considering the Viking thrust into civilization as the actions of a bunch of colorblind touristas, that was classic. That was unbelievable. Anyway, that's all I had this week, my friend.
Well, thank you, my friend. It's been interesting, as always, and I'm grateful to you, as always, for contributing to this small portion of the World Wide Web.
I appreciate that, sir.
And the burgeoning use of MP3s to distribute information. I think that's bloody wonderful.
I do too, and I am pleased more than I can tell you that I'm here along with you, Errol, on this cutting-edge thing that we're doing.
Yes, and the next thing is video. Thank you, Alfred Lindberg. We'll talk to you in a week or so. Actually, in 2 weeks or so.
Auf Wiedersehen, mein Herr.
Auf Wiedersehen, Alfred. See you next time. And so we come to the end of this week's program, which relies on your support, so tell your friends about it. Thanks to Dave Furlott, Kevin Randall, Alfred Lindberg, and to you both for being out there and for letting us into your ears. Till next time.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI at virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.